Hey there, if you would like ad-free and early versions of these episodes, as well as bonus episodes, movie club episodes, and lots more, head on over to patreon.com/Craig and Friends.
Make believe is not pretend. We might be ill, but we're on the mend. It never starts, it never ends. Welcome to Craig and Friends. Welcome to Craig and Friends. Welcome to Craig and Friends.
Hi, my name is John Mark.
Of course, you know that voice, that sexy voice, that alluring voice from the previous episode with Tammy Brown and John Mark. And of course, John Mark, my guest on this episode of Craig and Friends, the director and co-creator of The Browns and stylist, photographer, director of many, many other projects, which I'm looking forward to getting into. But we were just talking about how long it's been since we've seen each other, which it was over 2 years.
Yeah.
And it was at the fabulous Tammy Brown gala.
Yeah, she did a gala at Hamburger Mary's in Long Beach. It was really fun. But it's like a time is just bending, you know, time yeah. and space. It's been a minute.
It really has. Well, it's lovely yeah. to see you again.
It looks nice in here. It looks like maybe you added some lights or...
You know, I did. That's right. That when you were here before, it was a little stark in terms of the lighting. So what I did was got the Hue lighting system.
Mm-hmm.
And they're LED lights, which means that I think they last about 20 to 30 years. I'm not sure. The studies aren't in yet.
Versatile and sustainable lighting.
It's important. And it's something that
Hue.
You have, yeah. brought to you by the Hue Corporation.
Yes.
Now, lighting, of course, is important to you.
Very important. Yeah.
As a director, what's the first thing that you think of when you have a project that you're about to attack?
What is the first thing that I think of? I guess the story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess the story or the vibe, the tone, the yeah. energy. Yeah. I'm not like, I would say like I'm a director, producer before I am a writer, though I do write a lot. So a lot of times the first impulse is something visual that mm-hmm. comes to mind.
So yeah, you get an image and a sort of vibe maybe
mm-hmm.
as the sort of guiding principle.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The new season of the Browns has a new home, right?
It does, yeah. We've scaled considerably this time around. I mean, the first season, I have a hard time even calling a first season because what it really was a Frankenstein of all the Instagram episodes that we did.
Sure.
So Out TV had wanted to order an episode of The Browns right as the pandemic hit. So then I was like, okay, what can we do here? How can we still, you know, give the show some mileage and figure out a way to evangelize it more with the world? So
yeah.
we took all of the short form episodes from Instagram, and we had like additional scenes and footage that we had cut because we were making the show for that, like, you know, 1 to 2 minute format. So we kind of Frankensteined it together, myself and my editor, Eric Kolosh. And it's honestly a miracle that the first season is as coherent as it is because of how it was made. So this second season was a really fun challenge because we actually got to write for the half-hour television format.
Yeah. And what's the writing process like for The Browns?
For our show, it just starts with like a lot of conversations between myself and Paige, who's the head writer on the show, myself and Tammy and Sheila. And I usually start by writing just an outline,
mm-hmm.
Of the whole season, kind of the arc as a whole.
And again, the beginning of it starts with this image that strikes you, right? Mm-hmm. Like a sort of vision of the vibe and the mood.
Yeah, absolutely. And we also, with the end of the first season, we were kind of left with a big question. Like Tammy like fled. So when that was kind of the one fixed narrative element we had to deal with in season two.
Sure.
It's like, where did Tammy go? What happened? How mm-hmm. does she come back?
Do you find that helps when you have one sort of restrictive aspect? You know, the expression that's to the effect of art is created by the restrictions that you have. So
oh my God, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, I look at my whole career as a filmmaker thus far, and it's dealing with a low budget, mm-hmm. dealing with available locations, available talent. But I think in addition to just that one restriction, I guess we could call it, of how season one ended.
Yeah. Yeah.
We also had developed these characters. So that was another guiding principle for the story, is just like, okay, we know who Sheila is. We know who Tammy is. We know a bit about her son, her dad. Like, you know, what do these people want? Like, what might be important to them?
Sure.
Like, how, you know, what kind of challenges might they face? What are all the ways that they could fuck up that would be funny?
And so I imagine that that is a nice feeling, to have these characters that you know, that you love, that you've created, that you can take into different avenues, and now you have a longer format with which to do so.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like I've been living with these characters for 3 years, because yeah. we started doing the little Instagram pieces in 2018.
Well, we were talking about it on the previous episode you were on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember, how long have you known Tammy? You've been working with Tammy for quite a while.
I mean, I started talking to her a little bit before 2018, but mm-hmm. I think it was like 2017 or 2018. We worked together on a music video that I was directing for the first time. And after working with her on that, I was like, oh my gosh, this is such a dynamic individual. Like, yeah. I have to find something else to work with them on. And then I was like, well, what about some kind of weird, like, sitcom narrative? What if Tammy was like my mom? Like, yeah.
Yeah.
But we just, with the first iteration of it, we just really like set out to have a good time.
Right.
I had no idea that I would still be here.
I think it's a good
on this.
Way to approach a lot of projects. Something feels good. A collaborator feels like someone you want to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Just see, you know, mess around, come up with something, screw around, especially with, you know, the availability of cameras now. Everyone has one.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, whatever, writing, just try something for those maybe thinking about starting something.
Absolutely. And I think that those are the most beautiful projects, is when they start as a passion project, I think, you know. I mean, this season is, well, we had money for one.
Money helps everything.
A big difference.
Yeah.
But this season is such a beautiful evolution. And just even to have the opportunity to develop those characters further,
yeah.
And make the world larger is cool. And I'm already just like dying to do it again.
Well, that means that season four will be even more exciting.
Let's go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But let's get back into your history as a filmmaker.
Sure.
And go back to when you first started getting interested in film, or maybe aware that you were interested in film.
Yeah. My entrance into the industry is actually as a choreographer.
Mm.
My undergrad was in dance. Did modern and ballet. In college, I thought I was going to be like a concert dancer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I quickly realized that concert dance is not really a scene that's super accessible.
Can you explain concert dancing just a little?
Yeah. Concert dance is usually like more dance shows that take place in traditional like theater settings.
Sure.
Museums and theater settings.
Mm-hmm.
They're often like the economy of that scene is often they're funded by grants
mm-hmm.
and fellowships and state money. And the beautiful thing about concert dance is that the dance can be a little riskier sometimes because they can kind of exist outside of the commercial space. That can get weird. But the audience of concert dance skews a little older.
Sure.
And, you know, going to like, I remember going to the venue in Minneapolis where I went to college, and, you know, tickets were $29, and everyone that was there was, you know, mostly over the age of 40, predominantly white. You know, you've got a house of, you know, 200 people max. And then I got into choreographing just like on a fluke for Lizzo when she was starting out.
Mm-hmm.
And Lizzo was doing like, you know, arenas of people and much larger venues, but it wasn't even really about the size of the audience. It was just the fact that, making dance in a music environment was really accessible for all. And it felt, just like a better fit for me. So that kind of gave way to working on music videos, which was really cool. I worked as a choreographer on a bunch of different music videos and started to kind of gain an interest in filmmaking just from collaborating with like the director of photography, the camera people on the camera blocking for the dance, or with the director on the, you know, how the dance looks and feels. And it got to a place where I would look at what the director was doing. I was like, I can do that.
Yeah.
That looks good to me. Like, I have ideas, yeah. You know?
How did you find the sort of transference of the choreography, either plans that you had or the images that you had? That would be how choreography starts with you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, choreography is also really driven by the music.
Hmm.
But yeah, an image for sure, a feeling.
Yeah.
I think that when you look at my narrative work, it's very physical. I think I love physical comedy. I love characters who, you know, I focus a lot when I direct on the embodiment of a character,
mm-hmm.
more than I do on like a line reading or the way something is said.
Sure.
You know, the way a character like walks into the space. I also just have kind of a penchant for like action.
Mm-hmm.
And dance and running and blocking. And I love to see characters like move through space. And the finale of this season of The Browns is actually quite action-packed.
Oh, fabulous.
Very action-packed.
On the level of Die Hard, I've heard.
Absolutely. Yep,
certainly.
Yeah,
certainly.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Slightly less destruction of property, but that's just more of a moral thing that you guys
if I had the budget, Craig, I would be blowing stuff up.
Nakatomi Towers down. Would be just out in the in New York.
Yeah, I would set LA on fire.
Well, maybe season 4, you know.
I'm just gunning for a tornado, to be honest. That's like my reasonable ask to the network.
I think so.
Give me a tornado.
I don't need the rain machine, but listen, we gotta whip up a tornado.
Right.
Yeah, that's not bad, right?
I don't think it's a big ask. Like, you just need some big fans. You, like, put a green screen outside the doors and the windows,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
A lot of sand,
get
maybe?
Some little papers and shit flying through the air.
Debris. You're right. Debris is the heart of a tornado, right?
Debris.
Yeah. It's the key to everything.
Goggles. Yeah.
So, I was curious before, and I sort of cut my own question off, about the transference of choreographing something for a stage into video, which probably obviously was an easy move for you. But could you describe the process of when you look at, you know, oh, blocking for camera versus blocking for stage?
Absolutely. I think that there's a few like guiding principles to shooting dance. This is all my opinion, by the way.
Well, this is what you're here for.
This, I guess. I think there's a few guiding principles to shooting dance well.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, like the first day on a music video set, I connect with the camera team and see if they know these principles.
It's always good, right?
Or if I have to strong arm a little bit. But I'm generally someone who believes that like dance should be shot pretty low to the ground. The camera should be in motion a lot, mm-hmm. you know, should be looking to shoot the dance in a way that doesn't always have to feel like presentational, but should feel dynamic. So yeah, I think you watching dance on camera on film will never be as dynamic as watching it live.
Sure.
So you have to block the camera in a way that adds energy to the dance.
I imagine it's like a punch, mm-hmm. you know, a theatrical punch versus like a filmed punch, you know what I mean? Or and even kissing, you know, like in a film, people are doing certain things that maybe people don't do in real life. Very subtle changes, but it has to read properly on film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And camera movement is a gift too. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so much you can achieve convincingly that, you know, there's a lot of fight scenes in the finale of The Browns. And I don't think that they would look nearly as dynamic if you were just watching them on a stage.
Sure.
The camera adds so much value.
That's true. Camera movement and cinematography in general is such a beautiful tool
mm-hmm.
to use, as is lighting, as is every aspect of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a favorite element?
A favorite
or aspect?
Aspect of filmmaking.
Or the project, like the stages. You know, sometimes people like the writing best, sometimes people love shooting, sometimes it's the reverse. Sometimes people like Robin Hitchcock, said he loved every step up until the actual making of the film, which he found tedious because he would, you know, extensively storyboard. He knew how exactly everything was going to go. For you, do you have a favorite stage?
Yeah, I think production for sure. Shooting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not a huge, I don't storyboard. Mm-hmm. I do like a loose shot list. I love just like that intuitive piece to filmmaking where on the day you're like, okay, this works, this doesn't work, repeat this, try this another way. What if we pull the camera back here? Like that to me is the art form.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Back to choreography. What was your first interest in dance?
I went to performing arts high school freshman year. And I had originally thought I was going to major in theater.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took a dance class and it felt real good. Yeah.
So you thought you were going to be in theater. And so you thought maybe acting was the way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I had done a lot of acting when I was younger, musicals and such.
Mm, give me some of the titles.
Well, I was Oliver in Oliver.
Well.
It was a middle school production.
Yes, but the title role.
The title role.
Yes.
Yeah. I was in Sound of Music. I played Kurt. I was a monkey in The Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
I was Nathan Detroit in Guys and Dolls Jr. No, this is not what I came here to talk about, Craig.
Yes.
My middle school theater career.
Really? But you know, we get into all aspects of
it. It's formative, I suppose.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about. Formative. Yeah. Formative. We're getting a sense of what shaped your aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
What did you come here to talk here about?
I came to talk about your lighting.
Yeah, well, we already did that. We'll get back to it. We'll get back to it. We can break down light by light, but this is audio only.
Yeah. I do love acting, though. And I still act.
Well, and you still
some.
Act, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's nice to have a wide range of abilities and interests that you can execute and incorporate in your projects.
Yeah. Directing is the goat, though. I love directing. I hope to gradually write myself out of the Browns. That's the plan.
Yeah.
Season to season.
Okay. Yeah. Well, maybe the tornado takes you out.
Oh, my God. A dramatic death.
Yeah. Or it's a cliffhanger, like Who Shot JR? Mm-hmm. The tornado happens. Maybe move it up earlier in season 4. And you're just gone.
I like that. Imagine me just spinning around.
Yeah, right.
And then whirling in the sky.
You could, you know, all the different shots you can do with that. I mean, look, you know, you're the choreographer.
Right.
A dance number inside the tornado.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. I do love like surrealism. Mm. I love to get weird. I don't know that in my life I'll ever direct like a straight drama based in real time in reality.
Yeah.
Like there's always got to be like a drag queen or a time machine or like an evil villain or you know,
a combination perhaps of all,
right? A talking fish, I don't know, something a little off.
Yeah, that's fine. There's plenty of people who can make the stuff that doesn't have those elements.
That's right.
We were talking about you being in musicals, but what about music that you liked when you were growing up?
Oh my God. I grew up very Christian, so...
Interesting. Is this Maryland, you said?
Uh-huh.
Was it
Minnesota.
Maryland? Minnesota. It was one of the M's, one of the big M's. Yeah.
Minnesota.
Yeah. So very religious in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. What part of Minnesota?
Minneapolis. Mm. I was lucky to be in the mix, but I had a lot of like weird Christian artists that I don't even remember. I think Avalon. They did a lot of a cappella.
Uh-huh.
They were cool. They used to have like, my dad would take me to the Christian bookstore. He'd be like, you can pick out one compact disc. I don't know if he said compact disc. He probably said CD.
Well, still.
But, and then they had like every genre there, but it was all Christian. So I found this like Christian techno artist called Ultra Beat.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Christian techno. So I listened to that. And then in high school, I did manage to get my hands on like a good Charlotte CD. But I don't know. I like all kinds of music. Jazz. I liked jazz a lot. My mom was a jazz pianist.
So there was a lot of music in the house.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
What were your family's opinions about secular music and secular entertainment?
I think that I kind of strong-armed them in a chilling out in high school, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, once your kid is like 16, there's only so much you can do.
Sure, but right? Up to 16, it was a little...
Yeah, it was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my dad was a pastor as well, and I was very involved in the church, and a lot of like my early performing was in the church as well. And I would my first choreo job was I would choreograph the angels in the church Christmas pageant.
Oh wow! Okay.
Yeah.
So really, your interest in dance was sparked maybe a little bit younger than you realized.
Yeah.
Or your abilities, let's say, to put a number together.
Yeah. I suppose. The church is very dramatic. I mean, it was fun, you know?
Well, no, it is dramatic. The smoking purses, all that stuff.
Yeah. They had bats that would, like, swoop around in the sanctuary.
Really?
It's high drama.
Would those be the bats of the Belfry?
That's the bats of Brooklyn Center.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the infamous. Yeah, I love that docuseries.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The bats of Brooklyn Center.
It's really good. Yeah, yeah. It's like 24 parts, each 3 hours. Mm-hmm. But get into it. I'm not sure what network it's on. But it might be streaming, though. No. Well, check it out.
Everything's on demand now.
That's right.
You can literally type in Google anything, and you can watch it on demand.
Especially on Tubi.
Tubi.
T-U-B-I. Yeah.
Check it out.
Yeah, Hugh and Tubi. They're just changing the world.
Hugh, Tubi.
So if the predominant entertainment in the household was Christian music or instrumental, I'm guessing, because of the jazz leanings of your mother. Now, your dad, was he a jazz head as well? Or
no, but he would lead worship in the church band.
Did he play an instrument as well? Or
mostly, he could play a little guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you ever fiddle with an instrument?
I did a year of string bass,
mm-hmm.
which was so heavy, and I was just so small and so thin, and that string bass was so heavy to carry around.
It's really rough on the fingers, too.
Yeah, but I liked it. I chose that one because it was versatile. It could do jazz. It's the only orchestra instrument that could also do jazz.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Yeah, and then I did piano, but mm-hmm. when your mom's your piano teacher, it's just like hard.
That's very difficult. Yeah. Would you have trouble staying motivated, or was it just the mom-son relationship sort of overriding the instructional capabilities?
I can't put all the blame on her. I mean, I think
why
that
not? She's not here.
There's something kind of type A about piano practice, and I'm just very not type A. I had a hard time motivating the practice piece mm-hmm. of it, but I really enjoyed when I would get a piece down, I really enjoyed performing it on the piano.
Yeah, the beginning of any instrument, the first year, it's a lot of just repetition.
Yeah. I wish I'd stayed. I mean, I was like, I did piano for a number of years, and I was like a couple years away from sight reading, being able to just like sight read pretty effortlessly. So mm-hmm. I'm bummed I gave it up when I did. And she told me, she was like, "You're going to be mad that you didn't stick with it." And I was like, "No, I'm not, Mom.
I'm sick of this.
Know?
Yeah,
you don't want to dance." And we had a blind piano tuner.
So he was very accurate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was good.
How often was the piano tuned? It was always kept in tune?
I mean, I don't remember the piano tuner coming over more than like maybe twice a year.
Well, I guess it depends on the humidity of the area. I mean,
that's true.
In that area, it's not that humid, right? So Minnesota and a religious upbringing. How many mm-hmm. times would you go to church? Because I've discovered with some recent guests that the once a week thing sometimes just ain't nowhere close.
Twice a week.
Twice a week. Yeah. What days of the
Wednesdays
week?
And Sundays.
What is it about Wednesday? I've heard that a couple times from people who go more than once, that Wednesday seems to be mm-hmm. the other big day.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's just like midweek. Wednesday would be a lot more like small group type stuff, like, you know, youth group and rehearsal for what we're going to do on Sunday.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I see. Again, very theatrical, dramatic church.
Mm-hmm.
You're rehearsing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. My dad and I used to write little skits for like that we'd perform on Sunday in the youth sermon mm-hmm. about like good values.
Oh, okay.
So it'd be like, we'd have lightsabers, and then we would be like, there'd be like a virtuous, like Christian lightsaber person. And mm-hmm. there'd be like a demon with a lightsaber representing like dishonesty or mm-hmm. envy or, mm-hmm. you know, some negative value.
Yeah.
And that's how every skit would end, is with a lightsaber battle.
So then what was school like for you? Did you enjoy school?
I did. High school was great because I was in an arts environment, and that was nice.
Yeah. But prior to high school, did you like school?
Yeah.
Yeah, not nowhere near as much as
yeah indifferent. I mean, I liked opportunities to be creative. I think I pretended to be interested in a lot of things I wasn't interested in, like many young queers do.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, I didn't have a particularly like negative school experience.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, when did you start to get an inkling that you were queer?
I was a late bloomer. I was like completely clueless until I was almost in the ninth grade.
Well, that's, you know, that's not that late.
Yeah, but like to not even, yeah. Yeah, it was ninth grade, and it was like I fell in love with this guy. Who changed the game.
Okay, so there was a relationship.
There was, sort of. I mean, in my mind, there was. I don't know if he would characterize it as that. But it was weird. I mean, it was 2005, and it still wasn't super common to like come out in high school, so we were all closeted. Even though we were at an art school, it's hilarious.
Location is everything, as they always say in real estate.
It's true. It's very true.
So was it like smooching or something like that, or just a special friendship?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. When was your first full sexual experience?
My first full sexual experience, Craig? Oh my God. I guess like
are
in high school. Are
you surprised that I'm asking you that?
I mean, I know where I am. It was in high school. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was in high school.
No, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, like middle of high school, like right in the center.
Yeah.
That's good. So then it seems like things were going smoothly.
Yeah, that was a game changer, because once that happens, you really do walk around a little different. You're like, yeah, I am this. This is what it is. This is the gig. Like, everyone better get used to it.
Yeah.
And I knew with confidence then. And I was pretty lucky, even though my parents were religious when I was younger, they came around fairly quickly. Not right away, but fairly quickly.
What was it like when you first discussed it with them, or did you discuss it with them? How did it come about that they were made aware?
I brought it to them, and they were like, no, you're not. And I was like, okay, maybe we'll try again later. And I brought it up a second time, and they were like, are you sure? I don't know. I don't think you are. Like, I don't, I'm like, okay, guess I'll bring it up later. And then I brought it up again. They were like, okay, yeah, let's figure this out, I guess. And they were really sweet. They went to like a PFLAG meeting, just like Parents for Gays and Lesbians, because they didn't grow up really knowing any queer people. So they went and learned more about the community. And they're very sweet and supportive.
Well, that's lovely.
Yeah.
I'm happy to hear that. And what is the queer community like in Minnesota, or Minneapolis rather?
Minneapolis, it's pretty vibrant. There's like a huge dichotomy between the Twin Cities and then like greater Minnesota, I would say.
And what is that? How would you describe it?
It's pretty liberal. It's pretty international, like in the Twin Cities. Like Minneapolis has the greatest, the largest population of like Hmong and Somalian refugees in the United States.
Oh, wow.
You can get just about any kind of food there. There's like a pretty good amount of gay clubs per capita. But greater Minnesota is pretty conservative.
Interesting.
So you can drive, we went to visit some friends that we met on like a trip once. It was like 4 hours outside the city. And I felt like I was on another planet. The looks I got in the Denny's, Craig. The looks.
Yeah. Oh, the looks in the Denny's.
The looks in the Denny's.
I remember driving out of Louisville, Kentucky on a road trip to New Orleans. And maybe about 90 minutes away, we thought, let's get gas now. And we'd been in Louisville for like 2 weeks or something. Louisville's very different from the rest of Kentucky.
Yeah.
And you really don't realize that until you go a little further, especially with my first time there. And yeah, it was similar to Wendy's in a gas station, you know.
Yeah. Spooky.
Yeah.
Driving across America, I get spooked a lot, quite a bit, you know.
Have you gone back and forth a lot? Driven around the country a lot?
I've done a road trip from Minnesota to LA. I've done a road trip from Minnesota to Florida. So those trips have taken me through.
Through it.
Through it. Yeah. The full journey. But I love Los Angeles.
Now, when did you first think of moving to Los Angeles?
I moved here 3.5 years ago. I had moved back out of college. I moved to New York for a few years, and then I moved to China for about a year and a half.
Wow.
And then I moved back to Minneapolis thinking that I was just going to be there for a little pit stop. And then I had like a bit of a quarter life crisis and became a high school teacher for a few years.
Wow.
And
what subject were you teaching?
I was teaching dance electives and mm-hmm. history electives.
That's an interesting combination. So you have a deep love for history then.
I do. I love history.
What, any particular tunnels of history?
I love film history. Mm-hmm. I love musical theater history. Those were like the two electives that I taught.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense. It's good. I mean, you love them, so
yeah.
It's much better than some other subject.
I can't imagine if they asked me to teach, you know, Russian history, yeah. European history. Well, I wouldn't be qualified, first of all.
Here are the books. We start in 2 weeks, yeah. And good luck. Yeah.
I mean, teaching film history pushed me, though. You know,
because you already had a love for film, I imagine,
I had a love
right?
for film, but to create a syllabus is a whole other
kettle
beast.
Of fish. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Kettle of beasts.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What are some of the films that you remember first loving when you were younger?
Always loved action. I love James Bond.
Sure.
Speed with Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock is one of my favorite movies of all time.
So then what's your take on Speed 2?
On the cruise ship?
Is that what it is?
It's a cruise ship. Oh. It's an out of control cruise ship.
Then maybe I have to see it because that
it's bananas.
Scenario is
yeah.
fantastic.
It's
yeah.
good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I trust Keanu Reeves. The John Wick series is great.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite Bond?
That's hard. The World Is Not Enough. I'll just say.
Sure.
That's the first impulse with yeah. Denise
well,
Richards.
First impulse means that's how you mm-hmm. you feel in your heart.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Star Wars, Craig.
I'm
a huge Star Wars fan.
Oh, fantastic. So
Empire Strikes Back.
Mm-hmm. That's like your favorite of the Star Wars films?
Of course.
Mm. What's the director's name again? Irving Kirshner. Irving Kirshner, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Nice that's Jewish gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Great director.
Yeah, he did I'm trying to remember his other films right now. We could look them up.
Mm-hmm.
But and David Lynch was approached to do Return of the Jedi, right?
I didn't know that.
He was, but he elected to do Dune instead.
Okay.
But who knows what that would have been like, him directing Return of the Jedi? Because I don't know, you know, he had trouble with Dino De Laurentiis. I don't know, maybe he might have had trouble with George Lucas.
Right.
And then we wouldn't have had the bizarre masterpiece that is Dune.
It's true. Yeah, George Lucas is not, his movies, his Star Wars movies are not the strongest ones.
Interesting. Now,
in my opinion.
His would be, of course, the first one. Mm-hmm. And then the others.
That one's good.
Yeah,
but that's like, come on.
Yeah.
That's like the origin. That's like
well,
the foundation of the whole thing.
But I'm thinking the rest in terms of
because he directed the prequels.
Oh, he directed all the prequels. Okay,
I believe.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I've only seen 1.5 of the prequels. I wasn't terribly keen on those, although I really liked that last batch. Although I haven't seen all of them,
mm-hmm.
the one with Adam Driver and
Carrie Fisher.
Yes, of course.
I'm a huge Carrie Fisher fan.
I was just watching one of her projects the other day that I'm sure you would love if you haven't seen it already. It's on Prime. It's These Old Broads with Joan Collins, Shirley MacLaine, Debbie Reynolds, and who else is in the supporting cast? Kevin Nealon has a funny cameo.
I need to watch this.
It's so good. And so Carrie Fisher wrote it. And Liz Taylor, that's who else is in it. So there's a major thing in it where the Liz Taylor character and the Debbie Reynolds character have this conversation about how one of them stole the other one's husband.
Oh my God.
It is wild.
Incredible.
Because, yeah, the daughter is writing the dialogue for these two to have this conversation. For those not familiar with the whole thing, just look at it. Just look up Carrie Fisher, Liz Taylor, whatever. You'll see it in a second. It's a good time.
Carrie Fisher was like the Switzerland of that her whole dysfunctional family, though.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's true.
From what I've seen, she was the one who was able to, you know, have a relationship with Eddie, have a relationship with her mom, and have a relationship with Liz.
Yeah, know? None of those, I think, especially easy tasks, particularly her father. Her father seems quite a piece of work.
Was a dickbag.
Yeah.
What, have you seen Bright Lights?
Is that the documentary about the two of them?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I always like forget the name of last. It for some reason.
Oh, it's so good.
Oh, it's so good.
Such a beautiful doc.
It's so great. And I think it's up on HBO Max, or if you have HBO, go check it out.
Because, it's on HBO, yeah.
Yeah, and Max I love because it's got all the documentaries. Not all of them, sadly. Mm. There's still one that I managed to find, but there's a documentary from 1980 called Beautiful Baby Beautiful about the supermodels of that era that is just phenomenal. I'll have to send it to you.
Okay.
But Bright Lights is fantastic.
So good.
Now, you must be a fan of Postcards from the Edge then.
Oh, yeah.
That's really great.
That's a really good film, really good book.
And Wishful Drinking is great.
Love it.
I love everything Carrie Fisher.
Yeah. Basically. I've read almost every single one of her books.
Fascinating family, indeed. Yeah. And also, for anyone who struggles with any kind of mental stuff, her books are really a go-to.
Yeah. I mean, she was one of the first women in Hollywood to be really outspoken about mental illness and mental health. She had that like interview with Diane Sawyer.
Yeah.
When was that? Like late 90s, maybe 2000 or something, where she was like, yeah, this is a thing, y'all. Some people are mentally ill.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean we live in a loony bin.
Yeah. She did a lot for the whole cause.
Yeah.
Do you have any other favorite actresses?
I grew up on Tyne Daly.
Oh my, well, do you see the box set over there?
What? Cagney and Lacey.
The complete.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the reunion films are very disappointing.
Oh, I'm sure.
But if you'd like them, I'll send them to you.
I know her from Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, and Judging Amy.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. I saw a couple episodes of Judging Amy, but this sounds like it was a big favorite of yours.
It's all right. It has all like the exploitative nature of a Law & Order SVU, but with children.
So you love action. Would you like to make an action film someday? Like a straight out, you know, hardcore action film?
That's honestly, like, if you were to be like, John Mark, what's the dream? I'd be like, I want to make like a queer blockbuster action movie.
Mm.
You know, and honestly, like the finale of the Browns is like pretty close to that. The second half of the finale is pretty rockin'. But growing up, I loved action movies and James Bond, but it's just a genre that's like so devoid of queerness. And I think that I always, in my fantasy world too, would pretend that I was able to like do kung fu and jump off buildings and drift cars and beat people up. And maybe it was about feeling helpless in the real world and wanting to feel like big and strong and masculine. Mm. But I also just love the camp of it.
They're very campy. Action movies are like, they're the campiest movies outside of queer movies, I believe.
Yeah. I love the stakes, the high stakes.
Oh, yeah. High drama.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fun. And I love when they're creative. My favorite, one of my favorite movies of recent time is Good Time.
It's by
the Safdie brothers who did Uncut Gems.
I have to see Uncut Gems.
Yeah. The Good Time. Have you seen Good Time?
Yeah. Yeah.
Good Time to me is like the type of action movie I would want to make.
It's really stressful.
Yeah. And it, but it has like a grit to it. Mm-hmm. It's like very, it feels very like human. I don't know, like
know
kind of organic
mean.
And human, and not super like, you know, like the Expendables and some of these other, you know, Fast and Furious. Everything just looks so presentational and so polished, and it's they do the action genre in a way that feels gritty and real.
It's interesting you said the thing about the escapism aspect of it, which all entertainment is to some degree, but it's also therapeutic and to some degree. So you would imagine yourself kind of in those moments when maybe you felt like things weren't the way you'd like them in day-to-day life.
Yeah. I mean, I think that all kinds of little people dream of all kinds of things that make them feel big and strong. Some kids pretend they're in the army. Some kids pretend they're, you know, firefighters or policemen, cops and robbers. For me, I just have always really wanted to be a secret agent.
Well, that'd be a good move. Like, what if you were and we didn't know it? Because it's also hiding in plain sight, right? Which is another classic trope.
Exactly.
Of that genre.
Just start speaking Russian on this podcast.
Right. Like, it slips out.
Yeah.
Like,
oh.
And you're like, can you cut that thing that I said about Russian history? Because I don't want to, for no reason or anything. It's just, yeah, my parents are very anti-communist. Okay, yeah, that's the note I'm going to get. Being a secret agent, that whole premise, too, is in that movie about Chuck Barris, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. Did you ever see that with George Clooney?
A long time ago.
Yeah.
It's not fresh.
Well, the basic premise for those listening, The Gong Show was like one of the biggest shows of the late 70s, and its host, Chuck Barris, was also a TV producer, did, I think, The Match Game. He had like 100 shows. Mm-hmm. I'm exaggerating slightly, but only slightly. And in his book, his autobiography, he claims that he was also a CIA agent. And there's no way to prove or disprove this, so therefore it's one of my favorite stories ever. So later you're going to write a tell-all book, very similar to Chuck Barris.
Yes.
And
I'm a double agent for the country of Panama.
Wait, you were talking about immigrants before. I'm going to have to report you to the authorities.
Oh, my God.
I'm sorry. Just, it's my duty as an American. You know, it's rat people out. And
I understand.
But we'll get back to that later on. Your theory about how things should be filmed, particularly dance should be filmed. Do you have any favorite dance sequences in anything that you've seen?
Honestly, the best way that I've seen dance shot in Hollywood is in the most recent Suspiria movie. I think what makes it unique from other really dynamic dance films is the sound design.
Mm.
They work in like the breath and like the percussive nature of like your feet and body hitting the floor. And I think as a dancer, that's something that's such a visceral part of the experience that you don't really see from far away.
Yeah.
So it was like a mix of the camera blocking and the sound design around the dance in that film that really did it for me.
In the original, there's about 30 seconds to 45 seconds of actual dancing, and it's very just simple. Like, just put your arms up and walk across the room. Oh. Arms up and walk across the room. Other films about dancers, I'm curious to get your take on them. Whenever you watch a movie about a subject you know a lot about, sometimes they work, sometimes you go, oh, they didn't put one ounce of thought into this. And then there's films like Robert Altman's The Company. Have you seen that one?
Mm-hmm.
What's your opinion?
I like it. I mean, I don't... It is hard for me to watch dance films. Like, I can't stand the Step Up movies. I think they're terrible. Center Stage is fun, but it's like... It's ballet. It's very ballet. Black Swan was cool. It's funny, like, all my favorite dance films are so dark, and I think it's because, like... dancers are perceived to be these, like, you know, pretty little angelic things, but dance is grueling. It's a really tough physical act. And so I tend to like the stuff that when films are darker, you know, the dancers are troubled when they're, you know, like possessed.
Yeah.
To me, that rings more true.
Well, yeah, because there's a level of obsession. If you're going to achieve any level of professional work with dance, that you have to have, you know, and it's very taxing on the body, and you're driven, and also with some situations, the critiques are not necessarily that friendly.
It's something that pushes you. It requires so much vulnerability to be a really good dancer, and it's something that pushes you both mentally and physically. And there's not a lot of things in this world that I feel like push you on both of those fronts so intensely.
Sure. And as a choreographer, you must encounter a lot of different psyches.
I mean, I think that I'm, as a choreographer, and I've always been attracted to certain kinds of dancers. I can't even really put my finger on what it is, certain energies. But there's dancers out in the world who are technicians, where they really are just like gymnasts. They're like, tell me where to put my body, I'll put it there. And there's a creative piece to it for them, but they really are like technicians. And there's other dancers that are a lot more, they like to talk about the movement. They're more connected to choreographers with a lot of story or a lot of process. There's, you know, there's all kinds of dancers in this world, but I guess I'm kind of like attracted to the spaces in between, between like post, oh, excuse me. How
that's
rude.
Okay.
Oh my God.
That's all right. It happens to everyone.
Between like, you know, postmodern dance for social justice and like technical gymnastic dance.
Sure.
I'm attracted to the space in between where, you know, we can talk deeply about dance. We can understand all the symbolism, all like, you know, what it means to do certain moves, but we're also not taking it too seriously. We're
sure.
enjoying dance as a commercial art form as well.
Oh, and of course, we have to mention All That Jazz.
Oh, that's good. That's yeah, good.
Right? It's yeah. one of the best movies ever
that's
made,
good.
In my opinion. Yeah.
That's a really good movie.
That's really good. Nice and dark mm-hmm. and very funny. And
sensual.
Yes, absolutely. It's got everything.
Yeah.
It really does have everything.
Yeah.
It even has like a moment where you have to cover your eyes if you're squeamish. It's great.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's got drugs.
Yeah. It's
in
got
a mundane
it
way, though. Like the drugs are just sort of part of the package. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. That whole sequence with the speaking of sound design, when he's having the heart attack
mm-hmm.
in the read through is one of my favorite moments of all time, because all the sound drops out and then you just hear his nails scraping on the oof, even thinking about it gives me the shivers a little bit. That reminds me also of other choreographers that you admire.
Jaquel Knight is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
He choreographed the Beyonce Coachella performance and NERD and Rihanna's Lemon video, which was really cool. And J-Lo's Super Bowl performance he did as well. On the like concert dance spectrum, I really love Netherlands Dance and Bat Sheva. They're mm-hmm. like an Israeli dance company. It's really incredible. Israel has like crazy good modern dance.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more about college. Where'd you go to college?
University of Minnesota.
Minnesota, right.
Yeah.
So you stayed in Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
but I imagine college was a lot more free and easy than high school
yeah.
days.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, both were arts environments, both were dance programs that I was in. So college felt very familiar in that way. But yeah, college was a blast, and it was cool to be dancing every day, but also doing like liberal arts classes. And mm-hmm. I would say, like, yes, I learned how to dance at college, but I also learned how to write.
Mm.
Like I had professors who really pushed me as a writer, and that's still like is something that benefits me today, even when I'm putting like a pitch deck together for a
sure.
show
yeah.
or applying for funding or writing a script or writing a summary or, you know, writing copy for marketing. Like, I think that those writing skills in college were just as much of a blessing as the dance skills.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, it's funny too, all the skills that you acquire throughout other mm-hmm. projects or other things that may not even seem exciting at the time or worthwhile later on. They add up into the overall skill base.
Yeah.
Which helps you with the thing you want to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you moved to New York, where did you move?
I moved to Bed-Stuy.
Hmm.
Yeah.
What was it like at that time?
It was fun. Bed-Stuy was starting to get more gentrified. I was probably part of the problem.
That's a good title. John Mark. Part of the problem.
Part of the problem, man. But no, New York was cool. I was actually, I moved to New York to model.
Mm-hmm.
And that period of my life, I was actually back and forth between New York and Shanghai quite a bit for work.
Okay, so that's what led you to Shanghai. Now, when did yeah. you start doing the modeling, and what was the occurrence that led to that?
I started modeling like freshman year of college. In Minnesota, it's very commercial. So like my first big job was like a Target commercial,
mm-hmm.
but because I was so tall and gangly and had a certain look, my agent at the time was like, you know, you're kind of a fashion look. So, you know, should probably go where the fashion is.
You know, that's always a good line. Go where the fashion
go
is.
Go where the fashion is. That sounds so much more dramatic than it was. Yeah. So I went to New York to do that. And then I was also like dancing a little bit. But to be completely honest, like I was always a stronger choreographer than I was a dancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always more interested in like coming up with ideas and putting dances together than just being a technician.
This holds the through line with you finding directing to be the most interesting aspect yeah. of filmmaking.
Absolutely. The modeling thing wasn't something I was particularly passionate about, but it was something that I learned could give me the opportunity to travel on someone else's dime.
What was it like the first time traveling overseas for you?
It was fun. It was a little scary. China is like not... let's say what China is. China is a wonderful place. It's a little wild. There's not a lot of rules. It's a little disorganized sometimes. I love the culture. I love the food.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, it was crazy. I was like in a model apartment with a bunch of Russians.
Wow.
Going to castings every day. And
quite an interesting deep end of the pool in terms of experiences outside of the country.
Yeah.
To be dropped into, to spend basically most of your life in Minnesota. Now, New York, sure, you were there.
Mm-hmm.
But, and New York is its own culture shock in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But then that's like really mixing it up. You got, and yeah, you're living with a whole bunch of other people you don't know.
Yeah.
In a, what, describe the model apartment.
The first one I stayed in, it was three bedrooms, and they would put us like two models to a room. So there's six of us in the apartment.
And a 50-50 chance that you'll get along with or not get along with your roommate.
I was pretty lucky. I had a few, like, you know, everyone's contracts start and end at different times. Mm. Everyone's on a different contract. So like during the probably collective year and a half that I was on different contracts there, I had like seven different roommates.
Mm-hmm.
But most of them were nice. A lot of like... One of them was so weird. He's like this Ukrainian boy who's like definitely workout obsessed. And,
uh-huh.
Yeah, they're very like, they just don't have an understanding of queerness too. So that they would immediately be kind of like, whoa, like what, you're gay? And be like, yeah, you probably are too. Look at you.
Oh, that's so funny. When you said modeling, you just automatically think that you'll be around people who are at least okay with the premise. Do you know what I mean?
Well, here's the thing is that like I was part of like, you know, the D-list model community, and we have different markets. We don't like, I don't get to go do like Paris and Milan.
Sure.
I have to do like Shanghai, Hangzhou, Shenzhen, you know?
Sure.
It's my circuit is different.
Yeah, but I was thinking more just the models themselves.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like after a certain just amount of exposure to the industry, you would, one would think or assume, but one would be assuming incorrectly.
But that's what I'm saying is like a lot of the people at my, the level that my agencies were
at
were literally like scouted from
gotcha.
A small town in Russia.
I see.
To model in China.
Gotcha. Right.
So they're going directly from a small town in Russia to work as a model in Asia. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So you'd be going back and forth. When did you taper that off and what led to that?
I think I was 24 and because I had kind of a boyish look, my competition was always 18-year-old boys. So that kind of got old because I wasn't a model that could really graduate to doing like watches and suits and car commercials.
Sure.
It was like a boy look. And so I was like, okay, I got to figure out something else to do.
Mm.
So then I went back to New York for a second, but then I went back to Minnesota just because I hadn't really been around my family and my little brother who's 9 years younger than me. And I'm very close with him. I felt like I had missed a lot of his growing up.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there for a second and trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And I was like, okay, maybe I'll start like an e-commerce business.
Yeah.
You know, it's like fashion adjacent to modeling.
Sure.
And so I started a store, an online store where I had like local designers do things on consignment, and that business didn't really pan out because then that high school teaching job came up and I was like, well, sometimes when a door opens,
let me walk
through this.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was teaching high school.
And what was that like, by the way, working with students?
Oh, it was amazing.
Yeah.
It's the most badass thing I've ever done.
Would you like to teach again someday?
No. it's such hard work.
Yeah.
It's such hard work, but it's such good work. And it was cool. It was a wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in an arts environment. is really cool. And yeah, there's just like nothing more pure than supporting young adults, honestly.
Sure. And also passing along information, knowledge, and references.
Yeah.
Like that might spark a whole new inspiration for some kid.
Absolutely.
What was your approach to attacking the history of film for students?
I mean, there was some like existing literature that they had and some existing like course planning that they were using, but they always encouraged us to refresh the syllabus, refresh the course. And I mean, my plan of attack, it's pretty much you just like go through time and you got to show Citizen Kane.
You do have to show Citizen Kane.
You got to show a James Cameron film. You got to show Titanic. Mm-hmm. You know, the Record Breakers.
Sure. What did you slip in that were not the standard?
I'm pressed to remember. I made them watch Empire Strikes Back. Maybe it was New Hope.
What's your feeling about Jar Jar Binks? We never talked about that. So
we never talked about that.
Yeah, if it's the loaded question that was lurking, like an
My
elephant in the
room. Feeling about Jar Jar Binks.
Are you into the fan edits where they take Jar Jar out?
I haven't seen those, but that's hilarious.
I love the devotion of those folks.
I know. My thing is this. I think Star Wars is meant to be given to the children.
Mm-hmm.
So do I like Jar Jar Binks? Absolutely not. But do I think it's okay for Star Wars to not make all its creative decisions based on the nerdy 50-year-old and 60 and 40 and 30-year-old fans? Yeah, I think it's okay.
Yeah.
I think they can move in a way that will entice children.
Sure. Fair enough.
You know?
Yeah. And then they change direction. Everyone seems to be happy.
But they're finding ways to make everyone happy. Like I don't talk to a lot of people who didn't enjoy The Mandalorian.
True.
The Mandalorian was good. Rogue One was really good. Mm-hmm. They do pretty well.
Yeah.
Considering how many generations are, you know,
deeply invested.
In it.
Yeah. What else did we not cover that you would like to cover?
What else did we not cover? I guess just how important it is that everyone watch the Browns.
Well, that I thought was obvious, but you know what? You're right.
It's very important.
It's very important.
You guys watch it.
It's important for society, I think. And as an upstanding member of society, do your part.
And we need people to watch it so we can do it again.
That's right, because queer...
That's how TV works.
It is.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I'm glad. I had a suspicion, but now you've confirmed it for me. And also, support queer artists.
Yeah.
Make an effort.
Support queer artists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's not the first thing that's on the suggested for you menu.
Oh, it never is.
Yeah. What would you suggest to anyone who's looking to follow a career in the arts such as yours?
Stay open-minded to doors that open to you along the way. I've had a lot of pivots in my career, but they've always helped me get where I wanted to be. So, I don't know. Don't be afraid to explore other artistic endeavors adjacent to what you want to do.
Right.
Because, you know, we also live in a capitalist society. But there's a whole world of, like, I always tell the kids, like, the high school kids always be like, oh, I want to be an actor. I want to be a director. I want to be a costume maker. It's like there's hundreds upon hundreds of different creative careers out there in the world. So much to explore. And also, like, you know, work hard, but also don't be afraid to like re-strategize and step back and look at things objectively.
Well, John, thank you for coming and sharing your philosophies, thoughts, and exciting news about the new season of The Browns.
Thank you for having me, Craig.